From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll track the storm threatening many Thanksgiving travel plans.
We're going to miss the main brunt of the storm. It will move up the East Coast, but it will bring a wicked cold northerly wind down into our area.
Plus, what does it mean to have the federal government give up its piece of General Motors?
It does end this whole notion of, at least officially, of government motors.
And a conversation with Heidelberg Project creator Tyree Guyton.
And no matter what happens, the demolitions and the arson fires, that magic in here keeps telling me, do it. Don't stop. Oh, it gives me energy. I'm saying, turn it up.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this Tuesday afternoon as we get ready for Thanksgiving. Some new data from the Census Bureau shows some intriguing migration patterns. Can you guess who's moving to Michigan and where Michiganders are heading when they pack up and leave? We'll talk with our demographer, Kurt Metzger, about what these trends mean for Michigan. Then, should we mix our private and professional lives? An interesting study suggests you might want to think twice before putting up those cute family photos at work. But first, it's official. Uncle Sam is pulling out of General Motors. And with the exit of the federal government by the end of this year, it's the end of government motors. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes has plenty of thoughts about the pros and cons of the auto bailout, which stands as an unprecedented government intervention in a cornerstone American industry. Daniel, the exit of the feds from GM really doesn't mean an end to the debate over whether the auto bailout should have happened, right?
No, and I don't think it ever will, frankly. I mean, there's a lot of very passionate and I think logical debate over the federal government taking over and buying essentially a private company. And it was controversial 5 years ago. It remains controversial. There are still people that say they will never buy a car from government motors, even though the feds will no longer own a single share of General Motors. It doesn't really matter to some people. I also think that bleeds over into the politics of the bailouts and the political feelings towards the Obama administration and the president himself.
Well, and you've pointed out in your column in the news that those folks that are criticizing it, a lot of them are getting their facts or the spin wrong, aren't they?
Yeah, and for people like me that have been in the middle of this for a very long time, it's very disconcerting. And the best example is the Chevy Volt. You heard from a lot of people on the right, conservative blogs, cable networks, websites, this contention that General Motors built the Volt on orders, essentially, from the Obama administration.
Right.
Which is absolutely wrong. It was first shown as a concept in 2007. It was announced that they would produce the vehicle in early 2008. This is before Barack Obama even had the nomination, much less was elected president, much less was making a decision on whether to rescue General Motors or not. It's just one of many fallacies in terms of how the thing unspooled. The other thing I think that's also very important is that a lot of what the Obama administration did was patterned after what the Bush administration did.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think no matter who you are in the White House and you're faced with a very unprecedented economic crisis like they were in late 2008, you couldn't take the political risk of cratering one of the largest industries in the United States. Now, there are a lot of people that say, well, it wouldn't have cratered. Well, but a lot of the people that were very much involved in that said that there was no financing available in the private markets, and this would have been the largest bankruptcy financing ever done in the United States at a time when essentially the financial machinery had ground to a halt.
Right, right. Daniel, what does the end of federal ownership mean in practical terms for GM?
In practical terms, I think, first thing that people will talk about is that it takes off the caps on executive compensation. Which is kind of ironic. I mean, that you would have what at this time was a pretty small shareholder was still wielding a veto power over compensation, which basically doesn't exist in private industry today. If you own 2, 3, 4% of a company, you can't veto the compensation decisions of management.
But if you're Uncle Sam, you can.
Nevertheless, because they were a federal government, they were able to do that. I think that's one of the most obvious things. But I think more practically is it does end this whole notion, at least officially, of government motors, that it's not owned by the government. This is not like an English or a British takeover of car companies in order to save them, which they did in the UK in the 70s. It's a company that is independent and has moved on.
Let's talk about General Motors as it looks today. As you put it, GM's workout is not done, is it?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not. And anybody that would think that doesn't recognize a couple of things. One is how screwed up it was 5 years ago. Two, also some of the progress that was being made. And three, how they're going to have to continue to evolve. I think CEO Dan Akerson still sees the company as look too bureaucratic. Its product development is a little too slow for his taste, although markedly better than it was. I don't think there's any question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was getting better before the bankruptcy. A lot of the things that you see in place in 2011 and 2012 were really put in motion by the guys who have now been discredited as having run the company in the ground. The fact of the matter is they were doing a lot of things right, but they just couldn't outrun the bear of debt and when the market collapsed on them. But they've got a lot more to do. I think there's some frustration with their personnel, the way they manage people. They have a long history of taking underperforming managers at mid and higher levels and demoting them, and they talk about that. And there have been meetings where executives have been asked, how many of you in the room have demoted people? And almost everybody raises their hand. What happens then is you have younger people in their 30s and their early 40s who are ambitious, who really were ready to move, they've got high potential, but there are people above them that have been pushed around and demoted that are kind of taking up space. And it's a real problem for them at General Motors that they're trying to deal with, and Akerson has made it clear to people that we're not going to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If people aren't doing the job, we've got to let them go and let them go on and do something else with their lives so we can get people into these jobs that want to make a difference, want to embrace the world as it is and not as they wish it was.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House, have a very happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you.
And Thanksgiving doesn't just mean turkey. It also means travel. AAA figures that over 43 million of us will travel at least 50 miles from home during the upcoming holiday weekend. So absolutely no thanks to Mother Nature for slamming much of the nation with a big, dangerous winter storm this week. MLive meteorologist Mark Torregrossa joins us now. Mark, we've seen the headlines from the west as this storm pushed through earlier in the week. This is a dangerous one, isn't it?
It is. It's a big one, moisture-laden storm, and it's kind of a complex question, so let's get to it.
All right.
Mississippi River westward, you're pretty much A-OK, I would say virtually for the entire Thanksgiving holiday season. So that covers a good chunk.
That does.
Of the country. East Coast is getting it today into tomorrow, and the big cities, New York, Boston, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, should pretty much be all rain, but heavy rain. So when you factor in the high volume of travelers along with the heavy rain that does delay some flights, it can be a snafu. The problem area is from western New York through Pennsylvania into eastern Ohio, down through West Virginia, and I think a real problem, Kentucky, Tennessee, maybe into northern Georgia. They're going to get heavy snow and ice, and the track, if someone was, say, driving from Michigan to Florida, my advice would be take the farthest west route that you can.
Hmm.
Don't take that real pretty route down through West Virginia, because it will be a nightmare there.
And it sounds like this is something that will not only impact road travel, but impact air travel as well.
Yes, because you're looking at a lot of the big airports on the East Coast will be in the rain. The big airports won't be in the snow for the most part, but the rain does slow things down. Now, back here at home in Michigan,
mm-hmm.
we're going to miss the main brunt of the storm. It will move up the East Coast, but it will bring a wicked cold northerly wind down into our area. And what a northerly wind does is it makes a band of lake effect that comes right down Lake Michigan and right down into northern Indiana and the far southwest corner of Michigan. So if you've got to drive from, say, Detroit, Lansing, the Tri-Cities, Grand Rapids, over towards Chicago,
mm-hmm.
the good news is the band of heavy snow will be relatively short, about 30 miles. The bad news is you can't avoid it because it's going to be in northern Indiana somewhere, and there's no way to drive around it. So you just got to slow down, keep plugging through. And the nice thing about lake effect snow is once you get toward Gary, Indiana, and you see a little bit of sunlight in a mile or two, it will look like it never even snowed because you run out of that band of heavy lake effect.
Okay. Now, what about in southeast Michigan?
Southeast Michigan will have often on snow showers. By winter driving standards, I wouldn't call it terrible at all in Michigan, but you could get a random half-inch or inch here or there where you have to slow down some. But in general, as far as what we have to deal with sometimes in Michigan, I don't think it'll be too bad.
And I know that there are folks who might be heading up north, let's say the Traverse City area, and I know they already got some snow on the ground, right?
Yeah, they did. They got about 10 inches this past week, and I was up there to able to enjoy that. What will happen is, I talked about the northerly wind making this band of lake effect in northern Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
That would be tonight and Wednesday. As we go into Thanksgiving, the winds are going to shift northwesterly, and that will take the band of lake effect into Grand Rapids, Traverse City, Petoskey, and up through the UP. It won't be super heavy, but there could be 2 to 4 inches in areas up there. So today, not so bad, but as you get into the Thanksgiving day, it will get trickier travel up there. And then I think Friday, Saturday, Sunday return trip, I'll fine-tune that on MLive as we go, but I think that's going to be fairly quiet, and I don't see any major storm heading back home.
And then just for of the many, many tens of thousands of people who love the Thanksgiving Day parade down Woodward Avenue in Detroit, that or the folks doing the turkey trot, of which I am one, it's going to be pretty cold, isn't it?
Very cold. One of the coldest Thanksgivings we've had in quite some time, so trot fast and find the hot chocolate. I would say you'll probably have a feels-like temperature of around 0 to 10 above.
Mark Torregrossa, MLive meteorologist, keeping us up to date on this big Thanksgiving week storm. Thanks so much, Mark, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and everybody in Michigan.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. A world-famous open-air art installation in Detroit has become the subject of a suspected arson rampage. The Heidelberg Project on Detroit's east side has had 6 suspicious fires in just 7 months. Those fires have demolished several homes that are key to the art project. But as Stateside's Emily Fox reports, the artist behind the project says he's energized by the wreckage. He's ready to begin another stage of his art project.
The Heidelberg Project is on the east side of Detroit. It takes over 2 city blocks. The street is covered with colorfully painted polka dots. The sidewalk is painted with colorful abstract faces. One house is an electric color of gold. Another is covered with stuffed animals. There are sculptures in vacant lots where houses once stood, along with piles of toys and shoes.
All right, thanks, Mo.
Stephen Sneed grew up a block away from the Heidelberg Project. He now lives on Heidelberg Street in the big white house covered in colorful polka dots. He says back in the early 80s, the neighborhood looked dead.
It was kind of rough.
What was it like?
A bunch of desolate houses, you know, windows bust out, you know, burnt up houses.
But in recent months, the kind of destruction this art project has helped keep at bay returned. A house covered with political messages and signs, another covered with vinyl records, and a third plastered with images of pennies have all been burned to the ground. An arson investigation is underway. The day the Penny House burnt to the ground, the Heidelberg Project was scheduled to have its annual fundraiser. Hundreds of donors filled a theater covered with decorations made from recycled materials. Long and twisted ribbons made from plastic bags hung from the ceiling. Tyree Guyton, the artist behind the Heidelberg Project, addressed the crowd from the stage.
And I woke up this morning and went over there, and the Penny House was, I couldn't believe it. I thought I was dreaming. But I want to say, as I leave the stage, we're going to do it again, and we're going to do it bigger, and we're going to do it better than before. Will you help me do that?
A few days later, I met up with Guyton at his studio near downtown. He's showing 2 paintings to Larry Gant.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Gant is a professor at the University of Michigan in the School of Social Work and Art and Design. The pieces are two abstract-looking faces that kind of resemble something Picasso would have painted.
By how much resistance?
Guyton reads a line from the German poet Friedrich Nietzsche. It's about creating good no matter the obstacles. Gans says he sees that in the paintings.
Look how resilient they are. I mean, through all that pain, and there was huge pain, okay? The knockdowns and everything else that happened to the houses. But look at that. Through all of that, there's like, you know, we got this.
Gans says he sees that optimism in Guyton, too. Gans says even when the city bulldozed parts of the Heidelberg Project twice in the 1990s, Guyton remained resilient.
When the ticketing happened and when the houses got knocked down, I remember you kind of looking there and your thought, you know, you had lots and lots of thoughts, but it was also, okay, so what's the next piece of art? And so I said, wow, this guy's, you know, work got plowed, was destroyed. And what's the response? It's more art. it's more art.
And no matter what happens, the demolitions and the arson fires.
Yeah.
That magic in here keeps telling me, do it. Yeah. Don't stop. Oh, it gives me energy. I'm saying, turn it out. That's the best you got?
Yeah.
Give me
right. Guyton's team has launched a crowdfunding campaign to buy lights and cameras to monitor the Heidelberg Project and to ramp up security patrols. He says the project is here to stay, and it's going to be bigger and better than ever before. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
This year's rare convergence of Thanksgiving and Hanukkah gives Jewish Americans some interesting challenges and opportunities for celebration. The Jewish calendar makes Hanukkah appear to drift slightly from year to year, but it hasn't coincided with Thanksgiving since 1888 and is not expected to do so again for more than 79,000 years. Just a little food for thought. And speaking of food, here's an interesting story for you. There's an exhibit going on now through December 8th at the Hatcher Graduate Library at the University of Michigan. It's entitled American Foodways, The Jewish Contribution. Janice Bluestein Longoni is the co-curator of the university's new exhibit. She has spent more than four decades creating a 25,000-item library of American culinary literature. It's one of the largest, most acclaimed private collections in the whole world. But Jan says she was very surprised by the outpouring of support she received from the Jewish community.
The problem was I thought we already had American Jewish charity cookbooks from all 50 states. When I discovered we didn't, I was hysterical. And I was thinking, how am I going to find these? Well, this network that I didn't start, this network, sent all over the country, all over the world, really, and people started writing and saying, I think this is a wonderful idea. I'm glad you're doing it. I can send you my grandmother's charity cookbook. I can send you my aunt's. I'll send you mine. And they all came forward. Every day was like Christmas.
In this massive collection, there are Jewish charity cookbooks from Oregon, the first Jewish charity cookbooks from Washington, California, and Michigan. And these books aren't the only Jewish material from Jan's collection. The exhibit features bakers and butchers, markets and menus, even food festivals dating as far back as 1660.
So there are kosher barbecues all over the country. Mm-hmm. There are kosher chili contests all over the country. There are all sorts of things. And finally, we got a little packet called Kosher Yiddish Food Festival in Cheyenne, Wyoming in 2013. Now, how do you like that? I mean, no one believes it. I didn't believe it myself until I saw the publicity for it.
There's a rich history of Jewish cooking and eating in America. When Jan and I sat down together, we spoke of what can be learned about the past and present from cookbooks.
Many of the books, whatever they nationality or group that put them together, they all had a certain underlying thesis.
What
we want
that?
To sell these books to make money to help people less fortunate than we are. It comes through so loud and clear. I can show you this, for example. I gave a lecture called The Old Girl Network, and I gave it to talk about how important these were to the women's movement in America.
And how so?
Well, it's because these women during the Civil War would get together and try to put up a cookbook to have funds for widows, orphans, the veterans themselves, for anybody who had been hurt, North and South, without any question. And they found out if they would say to their husbands, say on the farm, they'd say, I'm going over to Mary's tonight, you know. Mm-hmm. And they say, what are you doing? Oh, we're writing a cookbook. And the men would say, oh, cookbook, well, it doesn't matter. It's not important, right? But what they didn't know was that the women learned how to write, to ask people to write, to test the recipes for each other, to sell the books, to get the books printed, to do all the things necessary to raise the funds for their good cause. So they're all that way. The Jewish ones, I thought, the one thing I finally decided after looking at hundreds of Jewish cookbooks and thousands of non-Jewish cookbooks, charities, was that there was an awful lot of humor for some reason in the Jewish things that weren't in many of the other ones. I don't know quite why.
Hmm. It was a great idea to say, get us a collection of from all 50 states because, yes. Boy, does it reflect the diversity of the Jewish experience in America. And I have to say, you have one from a synagogue in Honolulu. Let me tell everybody the title. The When You Live in Hawaii, You Get Very Creative During Passover Cookbook.
Yes. I knew you were going to say that, and I would have mentioned it otherwise. But that book won an award from the Tabasco Community Cookbooks. And everyone just loved to have that, and we got a lot of comment about it.
What do you think it is, Jan, about Jewish food that really, I think, speaks to everyone? I mean, who doesn't love a great corned beef on rice sandwich or chicken noodle soup? Or for me, it's matzo ball soup. What is it about Jewish food?
Well, I suppose some of it has a good amount of salt and a good amount of fat. Well, there we go.
Great comfort food.
That answered it, right? But also, what I remember from growing up, I grew up in a Jewish family, and I will tell you that always we knew that anyone who was hungry could come to us. We were very poor, very poor, but anyone who needed a place to eat came to our house. It just was a way of getting together with people. It was just terribly important.
Quite a lot of stories in this exhibit, American Foodways, The Jewish Contribution. It's on display through December 8th at the Hatcher Graduate Library at the University of Michigan. It's been a pleasure to talk with Janice Longoni, the curator and the person who loves cookbooks more than anybody that I've ever met. It's good to meet you.
Thank you very much.
All too often, as school districts are forced to cut spending, programs like music get the axe. And that sorry fact robs students of the chance to learn music, to make music. And it leaves us to wonder, where will the musicians of the future come from? One Ann Arbor Elementary School is teaming up with the University of Michigan for a unique approach to teaching music. And they're turning to Venezuela for inspiration. It's called El Sistema. The program originated in Venezuela with the idea to teach disadvantaged children, to help them discover the power of music. Professor John Ellis is with the U of M School of Music, Theater, and Dance. And Horacio Contreras Espinoza, he's a U of M grad student studying cello, and he is an El Sistema teacher at Mitchell Elementary School in Ann Arbor. Let's start with you, Professor John Ellis. Explain to us just what is El Sistema?
Well, El Sistema is a music education program that was founded in Venezuela some decades ago and has been a great success in helping communities in which they are planted to become more cohesive and for the children involved with them to have a greater sense of their belonging in that community and having their music have a greater effect on that community. And so it's a music education program, but it's also a program about communities and families. I think there are a lot of things about music education that are universal. And what El Sistema tries to do is to take some of those universals and have the children develop a greater sense of personal agency in the community. They learn to work together, mm-hmm. and there's some peer mentoring that goes on. And so there's a lot of those things about how music can be an important part of their lives as members of their school, their family, and the community at large.
Well, Horacio, you were part of one of the original El Sistema programs in Venezuela. Talk to us about when you joined and what it feels like to be part of the program.
Yeah, I joined when I was 12 in my hometown in Mérida, Venezuela. And what I feel and what I felt from the beginning is that we belong to a very, very big family. It's very tight. We know everyone in the whole country that belongs to El Sistema. So it's like a big, very big network where we have access to everyone from the top members of El Sistema to anyone has access to anyone.
And Jan, how does this differ from a typical student who joins, you know, the grade school band or orchestra, you know, here in Michigan, who not in this El Sistema program?
Well, in a couple of important ways. First of all, just as background, mm-hmm. we've established a wonderful partnership with the Mitchell School, mm-hmm. and they have a very supportive principal, Kevin Carr, and a great music teacher, Dan Talley. And so Dan teaches them both general music and string instrumental music during the day. And so after school, most of those same kids come into the El Sistema program. And what they have there is a further access to instruction, not only from Dan, but also from our students who are specializing in the instruments that they're playing. And so as Horacio was mentioning, this in Venezuela, this access to a great network, we're starting that here with the relationship between the School of Music, Theater, and Dance and the children at Mitchell, and hopefully it will grow.
And is this the first El Sistema program in Michigan, or are there others?
No, there are others, mm-hmm. But that was one of the reasons why we thought we would want to start one here, because we also would like to form connections with other ones in Michigan, which would be another future project for
us. And that sounds like that's really key, isn't it, Horacio, is understanding that it's beyond my town or beyond my school. So you're saying that this really takes you above and beyond that.
Yes, and in fact, one of the things that José Antonio Abreu, who is the founder of El Sistema, says is that he found that practicing by himself in a small room was so arid. So he thinks that really the group learning and the constant feedback that you get from your peers as well as your teachers that are everywhere when you practice, it really makes a difference in the way that you see music.
Horacio, tell us what being part of El Sistema has meant in your life.
Well, I am a cellist because of that. I engage with cello playing so much. Then I chose it as a way of living. So basically, it has my wife. I met my wife in El Sistema too. So it's like my life has been fashioned after the experience I have had in El Sistema.
And here you are,
yeah,
graduate student studying.
Here, yeah.
Where do you want to take your life and your career as a cellist? What do you hope to do?
I have really enjoyed a lot in my life teaching. So that's what I want to do. I really enjoy working with kids and with also with college students. I have had some experience about working with students in Venezuela a lot. So, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to teach.
And how do you see it change the lives of these kids that you're teaching? What do you see happening up there as they kind of get a sense of themselves as musicians?
I think that thinking about ways to solve problems, concrete problems, and getting immediate feedback on that solution is very important because they get a feel of accomplishment, and that is immediate. It's evidence in sound. You can hear it. So I think the way you hear the solution of the problem, you didn't know how to play, and after a week, you know how to play. That gives a lot of a sense of achievement, and I think that will be very helpful for the children.
One other thing about that, too, is that the children are developing a growing sense of responsibility towards each other and towards the larger group. So their sense of focus and dedication to their practicing and to their playing means that it has an effect on how well the group sounds. So that's another important learning experience that they're going through.
Really good talking with you, Professor John Ellis, with the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and Horacio Contreras Espinoza, who is a grad student studying cello and an El Sistema teacher at Mitchell Elementary in Ann Arbor. Good luck with the program, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Data released by the Census Bureau is shedding some light on the question of just who's moving to Michigan and where Michigan folks are headed once they pack up and leave the Great Lakes State. Let's take a closer look at these comings and goings and what it means for the state's future as we welcome Kurt Metzger, Director Emeritus of Data-Driven Detroit, and might we add, the newly elected mayor of Pleasant Ridge in Oakland County. Congrats, Kurt.
Thanks so much. A whole new career, right?
We can always look forward to new horizons and
there
new challenges.
Go. I keep trying.
Kurt, there's been so much hand-wringing in our state throughout the Great Recession. We have watched folks migrate out of our state, and so here comes this kind of fresh look at migration. So unpack the data for us. What are we seeing?
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of the trends that people tend to know. Yeah, we tend to think that everybody's either, if people are leaving Michigan, they're going to retire, they're going to Florida, or they're going to Arizona. And indeed, they are doing that, and Florida is number one. But we also see them going to a number of other states that maybe it's not just the climate. I mean, obviously, North Carolina is nice, and Georgia is okay. Kentucky, a little less so, but Illinois, Washington State, mm-hmm. Ohio. We're seeing folks leaving and going to a number of states. In fact, 32 states out of the 50 took more people away from Michigan than gave back.
What about our net domestic out-migration? Have we slowed down a little?
The good news is, yeah. I mean, Michigan, because our population change really is determined by the out-migration. I mean, we have births over deaths, and we've talked about this before, mm-hmm. that our births aren't keeping up and our deaths are starting to increase. But really, the difference is whether we have a lot of people leaving the state, more people leaving the state than coming in, or the numbers are down. And so, fortunately, the last 2 years, we've seen a decrease in the percentage. We always send more people away, and that's unfortunate. But those numbers have gone down over the last couple years, and we need to look at who are we attracting, and are we attracting those who we wish to attract that'll build a future here?
Meaning younger workers.
Younger workers, right, right.
And as you point out, certainly that trend of the Michigan retirees heading to Florida is unabated. But you, as you said, there were other states where you kind of looked and said, that's kind of interesting, like Washington
right.
State.
Yeah, Washington State. I mean, I think part of it is a the idea of the environment and climate, but states like Washington, I mean, are seen as very progressive states. People are seeing Seattle and some of the cities that have really shown an attraction, a kind of a forward-looking view, much less conservative, I think, than Michigan, thought of as cool places to go, thought of as that have some real regional planning, regional visions, that they're working together, that whole collaborative, the idea of complete streets and much more walkable communities, those kinds of things that are being fostered in places like Washington and Oregon, and that's very attractive to young populations.
So, yeah, let's get into that more. So what things, Kurt, do you think need to happen to put the brakes on this leaking, this steady leaking, if not an outright gush, it's certainly a steady leaking of folks leaving Michigan? You've talked about improving the perception of job opportunities as being important.
Right. Well, I think that's very strong. I mean, what we've heard over and over and is that people don't recognize that there are jobs available in Michigan. And we hear over and over about the number of job postings, unfilled jobs. The message is getting a little bit better, but I think that people, for some reason, and I blame that on the way we've operated in our universities and not had those job opportunities or some of the companies working with universities to show that there are there's hope after college, that there are opportunities for jobs. We have to get the word out that there are good jobs available in Michigan. And
so you also have kind of a clear feeling that Michigan needs to maybe update some of its thoughts on gay rights and education influences because we want to attract those young, vibrant workers that have a life of work ahead of them.
Right. I think, Yes, after the job piece, and as I've said, I think taxes are one thing, but that's not what's driving people. But I think we have, and this will get me in trouble some places, but we have such a conservative state. We're looking again, gay rights. I mean, my God, gay marriage. Here comes Illinois. Another state joins the ranks of states that are promoting gay marriage. We seem to fight the gay agenda as much as possible. We are pushing against abortion rights. We are pushing against stem cell research. We're pushing. We know that young people are driving less and less, and yet we can't really get regional transportation and complete streets and the kinds of ideas that are being followed all over the country. These are the things that people are looking for. They're looking for regions that work collaboratively. They're looking, for central cities and suburbs that kind of work together and have a regional vision. You had a discussion around a city vision. Well, we don't have a regional vision. We don't have a state vision. What is it that we can all get around and put that message out? And I think unless this state becomes a little more walking the walk, I mean, the whole idea of investing in education and everything that we talk about being important, and young people are thinking they're going to have children. Is this where they want to raise their children? Again, it's those kinds of things that the state needs to, they talk about, but I don't think our policies follow those. We know what people are looking for, and yet we seem to go in the opposite direction in many cases.
Some interesting challenges and interesting thoughts. Kurt Metzger, Director Emeritus of Data Driven Detroit. As always, a pleasure to talk to you, Kurt.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.
Ask anyone here at Michigan Radio who walks by my cubicle. I love my husband, kids, and grandson. I love the countryside of County Cork, Ireland, and I love Roger Daltrey of The Who. Why do they know that, you ask? Well, because all around my desk, I have tacked up photos of my family, of the fields of West Cork, and of my meeting with the legendary Who singer. Putting up posters and pictures is something I've always done at my desks all through my career. But a study by University of Michigan researchers suggests I might not be doing myself such a favor with such visible expressions of my personal life at work. Joining me is one of the five co-authors of this research paper. Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks is an associate professor of management and organization. He's with the Ross School of Business at U of M. So what were you all trying to find out with this study?
So this latest study builds off a long line of work where we've tried to unpack these quirks of Americans' approach to work. Quirks, not in the sense that they're good or bad, but they appear to be this culturally unique approach, which involves putting aside one's personal life while in the realm of the professional.
All right. So how did you construct your research?
So in this study, ever since I've been in the academia, I've sort of found it odd that people really separate their personal and their professional lives. So it's not something to mention that you skateboard or you're in a band at night or anything personal. And so this norm of putting aside your personal life seemed to be something that appeared across a number of industries, but didn't resonate with what I saw traveling around the world, working in about 30 different countries.
So you're saying you'd go to other countries and people were very comfortable talking about what they do Saturday night or like me with pictures.
Yes. Yeah. So the idea is coworkers would see each other outside the workplace. Mm-hmm. Some might even go on vacation together. And Americans sort of after the whistle blew would go their own ways and would have different networks, some for church, some for sports.
Got it.
And keep these things separate. So what we wanted to do in this study was we wanted to just tap people's mental image of what was a professional and what was unprofessional. So what we did was we gave people these color diagrams of a cubicle, an empty cubicle, and these self-adhesive stickers of just about anything that you can imagine would be in the cubicle, from a shredder, a computer,
sure,
staplers, photos of one's family, religious objects, sports objects, and so on and so forth. Mm. And then we gave each person a description of the employee who occupied this office. It was somebody in their 30s who was very productive, but they weren't considered very professional. Or another group got that same description, but they were told the person is considered very professional. So then we simply allowed them to reconstruct what they believed that person's office looked like. So we didn't prime or push them to do anything one way or the other, just said reconstruct your mental image of it.
And were these bosses or HR people?
This was a collection of individuals who were working full-time who were taking evening courses at the University of Michigan, our evening MBA program.
All right.
So they came from a number of different industries. And also half of them had not been born in the U.S. and worked in the U.S. their whole life.
Gotcha.
They had been here in different amounts of time. When we looked at it, what we found differentiated the professional from unprofessional cubicles was the proportion of personal items represented in that cubicle. So it was okay to have about 15 to 20% of the content to be personal effects. Beyond that, really captured what people thought was unprofessional. And so on one hand, it may resonate as obvious because it's a cultural norm, and within the U.S., this is that culture.
Mm-hmm.
But when we looked at people who had not spent their entire professional life in the U.S., we found that this was not something that resonated with them.
Wasn't a problem for them.
No. They had definitions of professionalism, but it did not involve separating your personal and your professional life.
And why do you think that is? Why are we so intent in America in having that that border, that firewall, if you will?
Yeah. What's interesting, in a lot of business, we try to understand why other cultures do what they do,
mm-hmm.
Why the Chinese negotiate as they do, why the Latvians approach entrepreneurship the way they do, so on and so forth. And rarely do we turn the light on our own culture. And it turns out the U.S. is not a cultural vacuum. We have a rich, deep, long-lasting culture. And my earlier work established that one of the defining features of our approach to professional relationships is something that was laid in place by the founding fathers of the culture. The strong Protestant ethic really had two components. One is this idea that work is your moral obligation.
Right.
We're very familiar with that.
Yeah.
But it also contains this notion that you're supposed to put aside personal relational concerns while working. So the U.S. in its very early days was at the forefront of doing business with strangers, people who didn't share your religion. If there was a business transaction to be had, that was okay. And that also leads to a lot of success because you're not bounding your market.
Mm-hmm.
One of the quirks of that is it helps us develop in this culture, better than in many other cultures, the ability to ignore emotional and relational concerns at work. We focus on what people say, not how they say it. We expect people to deliver bad news in a very direct, frank way.
Mm.
We expect people to call us by our first names and ignore status differences. Now, none of this is done to perfection.
Yes.
But compared to other cultures, it's just a very different approach.
So if you come from, let's say, India, and you wind up working in an office here in Southeast Michigan, you may have a different sense of propriety than your American coworkers.
Yeah. Well, you get to the real heart of the study. It wasn't just about documenting a facet of American culture, but trying to understand the implications for cross-cultural business relations.
Yes.
So when we invite colleagues from other parts of the world to work on a project with us, or people have come, we've recruited talent from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
As true in any culture, trying to learn the unspoken rules and taboos is critical to one's success. And in our other study in this paper, we found that when people violate this norm in a subtle way, simply as talking about how with a new customer you might mention, well, let me back up and perhaps give you the study. So what we did is in this another experiment, we gave recruiters from around the U.S. the essay and resume of a potential applicant. And we said, could you evaluate this? And in the essay, the person described how they would build rapport with a possible client.
All right.
And in one, the essays were exactly the same, except in one essay, the person said, well, if I saw that they had a nice window, I might sort of compliment them and say, what a great view you have in your office. In another condition, for another applicant, it said, well, if I saw some family photos, I might comment and say, well, nice family.
Mm-hmm.
Well, making a comment about another person's family significantly reduced the odds the recruiter would hire you or even give you a second interview.
That's stunning to me.
It's a taboo. It's a taboo that you're supposed to know. And if you don't, it affects your career, which means if you're not in the know, then your career prospects could be damaged.
Yes, yes. So it makes me wonder over the years as I've been happily tacking up photos around my desk and wherever I can find a space. You know, for me, that makes me as a worker happy, as if I, you know, I'm working away and I can glance up and see a picture of my grandson. It just kind of gives me that lift.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that could be in the long run something that is detrimental.
Yeah, I mean, we ask people how they're doing and maybe a little bit, and it's okay for someone to say, you know, family's doing well, but you don't want to hear more than that.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Oh, well, little Johnny's going off and playing this. Okay, that's too much.
Yeah, too much. We don't want to hear how he did in travel soccer.
Yeah. I mean, and so, I mean, I've learned in my own career, don't talk to colleagues about being in an indie band or going snowboarding and so forth. And what I found talking to other professionals, if they've also figured out workarounds to this. So what they do, and I think when we were going by your cubicle, mm-hmm. if I can share.
Feel free. I'm going to put a picture up.
is that... they may have their cubicle look very professional, very few personal effects from the perspective of somebody walking by their cubicle. But on the wall that the other person couldn't see is plastered with photos and maybe funny calendars and so forth.
Yeah, so which is kind of what I've done. You can't see as you come in. You have to make a big walk around and see my exuberance and sharing my life.
You know, an interesting thing that we found about this is that it's not that we found Americans endorse and prefer this separation of work and family or professional and personal, but they think that everyone else cares about it. So there's a little bit of this pluralistic ignorance that, well, not I may not care about it, but other people care about it, and therefore I have to follow that norm. And a lot of aspects of culture work that way. So we're not finding people love this. In fact, there's other research which suggests people want, as you mentioned, the ability to bring one's personal life in the mm-hmm. professional and to mm-hmm. be whole and so forth. Other people, of course, do love to separate it. They love being able to go to the office, much like when you start a new school or a new mm-hmm. job, you have a fresh start, and keep those things separate. So there is a tension in the culture between this segmentation being very strong and favored versus it not being that way.
So should I take down some of my family and Roger Daltrey photos or all of them?
Never. You should do what you want.
There you go. Jeffrey Sanchez-Burks is an associate professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at U of M. His study on mixing or not mixing our personal and professional lives will be published in the Journal of Organizational Behavior. Very interesting to talk with you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. And looking ahead through the week, have a very happy and safe Thanksgiving.